We want to calculate the probability for a circuit. In the standard framework that you learn, operational quantum theory, what you do is you foliate the circuit. We've got these different times. There's no unique way of foliating a general circuit. But you choose some foliation, and then you evolve, you write down a some state corresponding to the preparation here. And then you evolve it step by step through the circuit, and you have a final measurement. These are the operators, and then you take the trace of that, and that gives you the probability of that circuit. And that's how you would do it, do the calculation in the standard in standard operational framework. Or in general, you just make similar if you use the Schrodinger equation. You'd evolve the state to work out the probability. So we want to find a way of calculating probabilities for circuits which don't require using this kind of foliation. Okay, so I'm going to show you how to do that. And I began already yesterday. I'll recap. As an intermediate step in doing this is we want to set up a general probability theory for these kinds of circuits. So I'll do that too. So what we're going to get at the end is when we calculate the probability for a circuit like this, just recap. So a circuit like this, represented diagrammatically, can be represented symbolically like this, where each of the wires has an integer associated with it. So for example, the wire A that goes from C to E has here got the integer 5 on it. You see A5 here as an output and A5 here as an input. And we're going to show that there's a way of writing the probability for this circuit down as an expression that looks just like this. It has the same form as the expression for the circuit. We have this assumption that we can associate a probability with circuits, and that probability doesn't depend on anything else. And that leads us to be able to factorize the probability. If we have two disjoint circuits, the probability the joint probability over both circuits is just the product of the probabilities. Okay, so then we set up this thing called the P function. So P function is a funny thing. It's a function of a linear sum of circuits with real coefficients. Okay, so A, B, etc. here are standing for circuits, and these alpha and beta are real coefficients. And the P function is defined to take this form. So it's alpha times the probability for circuit A plus beta times the probability for circuit B. And of course, these probabilities exist because we've assumed they do in assumption one. And then we use this to set up a notion of equivalence. So I'm still recapping what we did yesterday. We're going to say things like alpha times some fragment. So here we have a preparation. This could be a general thing. Alpha times some fragment plus beta times some fragment is equivalent to a similar expression over here if this is true. And the key thing here is that it has to be true for all fragments E sub A. What E is doing is it's closing this. It's closing each of the terms in this expression into a circuit, which means the P function is defined because now we have a linear sum of circuits with real coefficients in front. Okay. Is that, not everybody was here yesterday. Is that clear? What's going on? So in general, we have things like expressions can be things like this, alpha plus beta times some fragment plus gamma times some fragment and so on. So fragments, remember, are things that have wires left over, or they may have wires left over. A circuit is a special case of a fragment with no wires left over. And we say that one expression is equivalent to another expression if P of that expression with E, which closes, is a fragment that closes all these terms. And this expression, if any fragment that makes the contents of the argument on both sides of this equal to a linear sum of circuits, then we'll say expression one is equivalent to expression two, if that works for any E. Equivalence is a weaker notion than equality. So two things can be equivalent even though they're clearly not equal, and here's an example. So you can show that a circuit, so A is now a circuit, is equivalent to its own probability. And the proof of that is that if you take the p function of a product of a circuit consisting of two disjoint circuits, so E is now a circuit, because that's the only thing that can close a circuit into a circuit is a circuit. Well, we know that these probabilities factorize, and then the p function is linear, so we can take this probability inside here, and so we can see that A is equivalent to the probability of A. So that shows first of all, it shows that a circuit is equivalent to its own probability, and also that equivalence is a weaker notion than equality, because clearly a circuit is not the same as a number. Okay. So now we want to use this notion of equivalence to do some work in setting up a GPT. So what I'm doing now is I'm defining a fiducial set of preparations. So this is a set of special preparations. So in the case, for example, of a spin half particle in quantum theory, that set might be associated with spin up along the z direction, spin down along the z direction, spin up along the x direction, and spin up along the y direction. So those four preparations would constitute a fiducial set in the case of quantum theory for a qubit. And here, now, the A label, this A label here, is running over that fiducial set. So we label them by 1 up to k sub A, and it runs over the elements of that fiducial set. And notice the different fonts. So this is the ordinary math font in LaTeX. And that's the one that is a label that runs from 1 up to KA, whereas this is the Math Sans Serif font. And this one it just indicates what kind of system we have, whether it's an electron or a photon or so on. Okay. So this is a special set of preparations. And the idea is that it should be such that we can write any general preparation for that type of system as being equivalent to a linear sum, here we use Einstein summation convention, of some real coefficients. So there's alphas with a pre-subscript A1, sorry, A's, this A with a pre-subscript A1 is a real coefficient, times this special set of fiducial preparations. Okay. So there we have a linear sum of preparations with some coefficients. Okay, this is a way of writing down a general preparation as being equivalent to a linear sum with some particular fiducial elements. And we're using the notation in the diagrammatic case is like this, that we insist that, we put a black dot here, and we insist that we match that with a white dot. So when we place these two things together, what this means is that we're doing, it's a diagrammatic notation for writing down tensor calculations, and here we sum over this A.
Are the Italian capital A's here, like with this
Yeah, these ones.
three superscript A1, that one there.
Yeah.
No,
Here.
that one there. No, in the left, yeah, that one there.
Yeah.
That one there. Are those the probability vectors we know and love?
These correspond, so these italic A's correspond to a labeling of the different fiducial elements.
But would those be like related to the probability vectors we were talking about?
Yeah, so the relationship is in the probability vector, for example, this, B. Kudos, by the way, for coming in and asking a question straight away. That was good. So yeah, so in this case, this would be A equals 1, B equals 2, A equals 1, A equals 2, A equals 3, A equals 4. So they would be labeling of this Z, Z plus, Z minus, X plus, and X minus. It turns out to be very useful to use the same letters but in different fonts, even though it takes a little bit of getting used to. So is this clear? Yep. Okay. So we can do the same thing for results. So these are measurements which have an outcome specified. So so now the A label is running over a set of results, and they could correspond to, in the case of a qubit, it could correspond to a spin measurement along the z direction with the outcome plus, or a spin measurement along the z direction with the outcome minus, or a spin measurement along the x direction with the outcome plus, or a spin measurement along the y direction with the outcome plus. So that would be a good set of fiducial results labeled by, well, in that case, A equals 1 to 4. And now we have a superscript A1. The reason for the placement of these subscripts and superscripts and pre-subscripts and pre-superscripts will become clear later. And it corresponds to the sort of use of black and white dots as a translation. So we set up a set of fiducial results, and now we can write down an arbitrary result as being equivalent to a linear sum, so these are the real coefficients, over those fiducial results. Okay. Then you can write down, well, you can construct this circuit here. This is a circuit where we have a fiducial preparation followed by a fiducial result. And here we have all the different labels for the input, A, and all the different labels for the output. We have all the different labels for the fiducial preparations, A, and the different labels for the fiducial results, A. It might be clearer if I put an A prime here and an A here, because those are different numbers. But diagrammatically, you can see they're in different locations. So the A is just sufficing to tell you what kind of label you have there. Okay. And then we take the P function of this, or the probability of this. That gives us a thing with two black dots on it, and that's a matrix. A matrix with A and A prime as the running over the rows and columns, and it's going to play an important role in this sort of framework. Now remember, a circuit is equivalent to its own probability. So for any given A and A prime, this circuit here is equivalent to this thing. I call this the hopping metric. And the reason for that is that if you do this in symbolic notation, the role this thing plays is to hop the indices over the symbol. So it'll take pre-superscripts into superscripts and pre-subscripts into pre-subscripts. It'll keep the level, but it'll pop them over. Okay, so you have all these black and white dots. And we can use the hopping metric to change a white dot into a black dot. So we sum over here, then we change that into a black dot. All we're doing here is taking a vector and multiplying it by a matrix. Okay, we can do the same for the effects, the things associated with results. We can do, for example, this. We could take something like this. We can change the color of this dot to black, or this one. And so really, when we have something like this, we can just represent it by a straight line, because all these things are equal. So we have that this is equal to this is equal to this inside these circuits, inside these calculations. We can define the thing with two white dots just to be the inverse of the thing with two black dots. And we also have these things as identities. Okay, so now let's do a calculation for a simple circuit. So we have an arbitrary preparation followed by an arbitrary result. Well, we can write this thing down as being equivalent to a situation where we replace the bottom with the expansion in terms of the fiducial preparations, and likewise replace the top by the expansion in terms of the fiducial results. Now, this is equivalent to this because this is a circuit which is equivalent to its own probability. And then this is notationally the same thing as this. Hence, since this is a circuit and it's equivalent to this number here, this is the probability. Hence, the probability of a circuit is just given by an expression that looks the same. Okay. So at this stage, the whole song and dance has got us this result. We can go further, of course. Any questions at this stage? So we're starting to set up a general framework, for a GPT framework for these circuits. So this works in the sense that we have this nice property that the probability for a circuit is given by a calculation that looks exactly the same. We'd like that to be true now for any circuit. This is just a particular example. How do we make it true for any circuit? And we can make this true by assuming that operations are fully decomposable. So this assumption is equivalent to the assumption of tomographic locality. And what it's saying is that you can write any operation. So here's an operation. You can write it as a linear sum over fiducial results on the inputs and fiducial preparations on the outputs. Okay. So this is a bag of numbers. There's our fiducial results, and there's our fiducial preparations. This needn't be true, so this is an assumption. It's true in quantum theory. It's true in classical probability theory. It's not true, for example, in real quantum theory, so where you take density matrices and you restrict the elements of the density matrix to be real, then this assumption will fail. And you'll look at that today in the tutorial. Okay. Any questions on that?
I have a really dumb question. I know that we're making like a theory right now, but in the practical aspect, wasn't it like quite hard to condition these probability vectors in the first place?
What do you mean by condition them?
Like, you know, that you can, it's not enough to have them all sum to one, or because sometimes there are some weird conditions that probability have to obey to actually be from a quantum state, represent a quantum state.
Yeah, so in general, in these GPT approaches, mm-hmm. these vectors have to belong to some set, mm-hmm. and that's a convex set.
Okay, but...
Usually we don't assume that they're normalized. If they are normalized, in this example, the sum of the first two terms sum to one. Most of the conditions are inequalities, saying that it has
a lot of inequalities for quantum.
Yeah, so it can basically they belong to a cone usually. So it's difficult to draw. This is really a four-dimensional shape, so I'm just drawing a restricted version.
That's like a conditioning on the probability vectors or whatever.
Yeah, so they have to lie inside here.
And that conditioning. Leads to what conditioning on these
in quantum theory
operators in this project? It seems like it's going to be really painful to properly condition the.
Yeah, this is a good question. Yeah, yeah. So this is just for states, but we also have conditions on these objects for in the general case. And your question is, what is the conditions on this?
Yeah.
So in the case of quantum theory, there's a very nice way of writing down the conditions. I'll make a further step. I'll convert these objects here, mm-hmm. The things I call Dewar tensors, I'm going to convert those into operators, things I'll call operator tensors. And then there's a very natural way of writing down the constraints, mm-hmm. which are basically the inequalities that you're asking for.
Okay.
In the general GPT case, then you can try different things. It's actually very hard to find consistent theories which work when you compose things and everything. So generating, so you have this vast landscape of potential theories, but then we just have a few points in there for theories that we know work. So classical probability theory is a case. Quantum theory is another case in this landscape of possible theories. There's the Speckens toy model. Has Rob taught that yet? He probably will teach it at some point. This is a point in here. And then there's a few more. There's a guy giving a quantum foundation seminar this afternoon, and he has some more points in this landscape. But in general, it's quite difficult to find theories that are consistent with all this. So that's a very good question. Right. And here we're just looking at theories which satisfy tomographic locality. When we do that, then we can have calculations for our circuits which look the same as the circuits. What's not clear to me is whether this is the only way of making that work. It might be that you can write down more general calculus which doesn't assume tomographic locality, and will give you a way to calculate the probabilities for circuits using diagrams that look the same as the circuits. That's something I'm thinking about at the moment. So there's a general case. Here's just an example. On the previous slide, I just drew straight lines. I missed out the black and white dots. But here I've put them back in again. So you can see the black dots live next to the fiducial elements, and the white dots live next to the Dewar tensor. Although, of course, you can use the Hopping metric to change the colors of these dots. So this object here, if it has all white dots on it, this corresponds to the weights in the sum of fiducial elements. It's just this. And this is an example of a Dewar tensor. So what are these Dewar tensors? Well, in general, they're things like this which have black and white dots. Or if you write them down in symbolic notation, you have subscripts and subscripts, superscripts, pre-subscripts and pre-superscripts. And this is the map. So this would be a black dot on an input would be a pre-subscript. And so on. And that was just the convention I chose. It seemed to make sense. We can change the colors on these dots using these hopping metrics, hopping metric and its inverse. But the main thing is that on a Dewar tensor, each index is associated with two possible bases. So one corresponding to, so on the top, for example, one corresponding to fiducial preparations and one corresponding to fiducial results. So since you've got associated with the same position, you've got fiducial preparations or fiducial results, so those two separate bases, that's why you need a Dewar tensor instead of just a regular tensor. So I said all white dots. Oh, I went the wrong way. I said all white dots give the all white dots give the coefficients. What about all black dots? Well, those give the fiducial probabilities. So you could have a circuit. So you take some operation, and then you put fiducial preparations in, and you have fiducial preparations coming, fiducial results on the outputs. And then this circuit would have a bunch of probabilities associated with it as you run over these different labels. And those would be the Dewar tensors having only black dots. Okay. So you have these sort of dual elements. The ones with just black dots correspond to probabilities of circuits. The ones with just white dots correspond to weightings. And of course, you can have Dewar tensors which have mixed black and white dots, and they can be useful as well in some circumstances. Okay, so now let's see how the magic of this decomposability thing works. So we start off with a circuit, a general circuit. Well, this is an example of a general circuit, but you can see from this example that it will work in general. So here's a circuit. And now I'm going to insert the expansion of each of these operators in terms of fiducial elements according to that assumption two that I made. So here's the expansion of this one. Here's the expansion of C, see that, and so on. Okay, is that clear? And now each of these is a, so we're using equivalence here. This is equivalent to this. Each of these is a fiducial circuit, and that's equivalent to just having the hopping metric in there. So I've sort of reinserted black and white dots on each of these, and then I've put the hopping metric in. But of course, I can just delete, when I have black and white dots matched, I can delete them by the notational convention I'm using and have these straight white wires. So we can see that this circuit is equivalent to this calculation, and this calculation just gives us a number, and that's the probability for that circuit. And the calculation looks the same as the circuit. Any?
So can we, like, however it makes sense, rotate? I guess rotate the circuits in however time we want, like traversing time the circuits, and it will still make sense?
So really the orientation of this is just a convention I adopted. And later on, in a later paper, I decided to use circles instead of boxes. And then it really doesn't have an orientation. So it's just a convention, yeah. Yeah.
Is Aggie? It possible to write down a counterexample where the circuit does not equal to the calculation? Or in that case, is it just not possible to write anything down?
So anytime, I mean, I was trying to illustrate this by an example. But anytime you start with a circuit, whatever shape, and you go through this process, you'll get a calculation that has the same shape. Is that what you meant?
No. No, well, I mean, I guess the thing is, it just seems kind of, I'm not saying it's trivial, but it seems trivial, so it would be good to see a counterexample of maybe another theory where that doesn't happen.
Oh, right.
It's clear that it's profound.
Yeah, so I think it may, so in later paper, I talked about this general thing, I called it the composition principle. And the idea is that you can write down a theory for a situation in terms of a calculation that has the same compositional structure as that situation. And then the question is, first of all, to give some examples of such theories, and I gave a couple of examples in this paper I wrote. But then there's the question, well, are there any counterexamples? Are there any theories that cannot be done, but you cannot do that? And I don't know the answer to that question, but it sort of is reminiscent of the situation in general relativity. So, you know, Einstein said, well, let's write down our theory in such a way that it's invariant under general coordinate transformations. And he used that as a principle to construct GR. And then a guy called Kretschmann said, well, actually, you can do that with any theory. And he showed how any theory can be written down in such a way that that it's invariant under general coordinate transformations. And Einstein's response was, well, yes, that's true. But in my case, it's beautiful. And in the other cases, it's not. So this is really a sort of, so the composition principle is, it's not clear, it may have the same status as the principle of general covariance in GR, that it's a constructive principle that you can use to take you to a more elegant construction of a theory, but it's something that can be done for any theory. Or it may be that there are counterexamples, but I don't have one. Yeah. Okay. Any more questions? Yeah, okay. Well, this is the thing we just discussed. So what I want to do now is set up a framework which is analogous, but where instead of having operations, I have operators. So, you know, operators in the usual sense, defined as acting on Hilbert spaces. It's analogous, almost analogous. The reason for the word almost is because in the case I just showed you, you had the notion of equivalence. That notion of equivalence is going to be replaced by a notion just by equality. We're going to give these operators a sort of tensor-like structure, so the operators will have subscripts and superscripts. Well, I'll show you the rest of it. When we have repeated indices, in this case, rather than summing, we'll be taking the partial trace. Okay. So let's set this up. So first of all, we need some Hilbert spaces. So we define these Hilbert spaces. They have labels associated with the system types and dimensions associated with the system types. We define Hilbert spaces with subscripts and also similar Hilbert spaces with superscripts. And then a Hilbert space that has, say, all these subscripts and all these superscripts is just given by the tensor product of the corresponding Hilbert spaces. All of these are taken to be complex Hilbert spaces, and this thing doesn't work if you use real Hilbert space. Okay. So now I want to define the space of Hermitian operators that act on these Hilbert spaces. Okay. So I'm just going to denote the space of Hermitian operators acting on this Hilbert space by this. And then an example of an operator is this. And this is an operator that lives in this space of Hermitian operators. And you can denote it either symbolically like this or diagrammatically like this. And to distinguish this from the case of operations, I've put a hat on here and also I've used double bordered boxes. Yeah. Any questions? And here's some notation. So normally in quantum theory, when you want to have the product, the tensor product of two operators, you put a tensor product symbol in between. But I'm going to drop that and just write it like this. And you can see it's a tensor product because we have these labels, A1 and B2. They have different integers, so that means it's a tensor product. OK, the same thing here. These are just more examples. Here's an example. The main thing, this is a tensor product because we have different labels, one and two. Also, the order isn't important. We can write these things down in any order we want. It means the same thing because really it's just the labels that tell you what you have. If we wrote this down in diagrammatic notation, we just have two boxes with wires sticking out of them, and it doesn't matter where we put those boxes on the page. If we have a repeated integer like this, then what we mean by this is that it means the same thing as taking the trace. Okay, so in the new notation I'm using, this means we're taking the trace of the product of these operators. So we can do that diagrammatically as well. Here we have a repeated integer, which means we have a wire connecting this box to this one. And that means we're taking the trace of the product of this operator times this operator. Is that clear? We can also have more complicated examples like this. So here we have a B3, which is repeated. And all the other ones are left open. And what that means is that we're going to be taking the partial trace in the subspace associated with B3. And to make sense of that, we need to use, well, the way to make sense of that is to use something, the full decomposability of operators, which I'll come to shortly. Okay, so I'm going to go through the same steps as before. So we set up a fiducial operator, so a fiducial set of operators. So here we have a fiducial set of operators. They have a label A, which runs from 1 up to K sub A. Okay, notice the fonts again. We have a fiducial set so these are basically going to be associated with preparations. These ones are going to be associated with results. Everything is analogous. But the thing is here that this is a spanning set of operators for this Hermitian space, for this space of Hermitian operators. And likewise, this is a spanning set of operators for the for this space. Is that clear? Any questions?
So Ka are the fiducial states, the fiducial states like these ones here, C plus, C minus.
Which one? Yeah, so...
Yes, the Ks. And the A's we were talking about before were just the dimensions of the Hilbert spaces, or...?
Yeah, so let me give you an example of a fiducial set of...
I think this is...
Yeah, so here's a fiducial set of...
2K equals 4.
Fiducial set of operators for... say a qubit. So let me just use this notation for a projection operators. That should be an X. So there's four operators. They're all
two-dimensional Hilbert space.
We're in a two-dimensional Hilbert space.
Okay.
Yeah. This is a set of Hermitian operators, which span the space of Hermitian operators.
Mm-hmm.
And so that will be an example of a fiducial set.
Excuse me, Nancy.
Yep.
I think I missed it, but could you clarify again the difference between an operation and an operator?
An operation is something in the laboratory. So you go into the laboratory, you know, you pick up a piece of apparatus, and then you say, well, these things are inputs and these things are outputs, and I choose a particular setting and I identify a particular outcome. So that's a thing in a laboratory, whereas an operator is a piece of mathematics.
So now you're repeating what you did before, but for a mathematical theory, rather
than exactly. Rather
than application of what you're doing in the lab.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's the difference.
Okay.
But it's completely analogous, except that we'll have equality. Here we have the next slide, I guess. We'll have equality rather than equivalence. Okay, but I didn't write down a. Yeah, I forgot. I guess I should have written down. I have a slide where I said that a general operator can be expanded in terms of set of fiducial preparations. There's a pedagogical gap in this slide. Okay, well, let's just talk about that here. So here's a general operator. Okay, we can expand that in terms of a spanning set. Because any operator in this space can be written as a linear sum of a spanning, with some real coefficients, a spanning set. And likewise, we can do that for the one on the top as well.
Is that spanning set the same as the one from before when we were doing operations? Because it doesn't have any double lines around.
No, it's, at this stage it's not. And later on, we're going to sort of force the two things into a kind of equivalence. So at this stage, you're just doing the whole thing again by analogy, and then we'll make the two things match up in some sense. So this is just a piece of mathematics. It's certainly not the same because this is a piece of mathematics, whereas the other thing was something that lives in another battery.
But the spanning set on the left,
this is the spanning set of operators.
The box with the single line on the left.
This one, yeah. Yeah, so we want this to be the same.
Okay, so that is the same as.
Well, we haven't quite got there yet, but we'll be able to make them the same. Yes. Yeah. So we're going to define a Hopping metric for this theory, which is just here, just by taking the trace over fiducial. Circuits like this, but composed out of operators. So at this stage, we haven't established that these Hopping metrics are the same for the operators as they are for the operations. But we'll talk about that. Okay. So now we can do the same. Okay. So here is here's the case of operators, and here's the case of operations. We have the same structure, except that we have equivalence in the case of operations and equality in the case of operators. Since Hilbert spaces are complex, it's a fact that we can write a general operator like this. In this fully decomposed form, we can write it as a linear sum over operators associated with input operators and output operators, just like this. Yep.
Is this a dimensionality argument? Why it works for complex but not real? Or?
Yeah, you can certainly do it by a counting argument.
Is that the idea?
Yeah. Yeah. And the tutorial later today is going to look at this a bit. Yeah. So I think if you want to know why we have complex numbers in quantum theory, I think this is the best argument I know why this is the case. So basically, the product. I've done it symbolically. This tensor product of operators spans the space associated with the full thing. Okay. Notice there's an equality there, not equivalence. Okay, so now what about if we have a repeated index like this? So we have a thing like this. How do we calculate that? We just want to take the partial trace over this bit. The way to do that calculation is to expand them in terms of their fiducial elements. And now you have a trace of these components. So that tells you how to do this calculation. not the only way to do the calculation, but at least it shows that the calculation makes sense. Yeah, that's just the same slide. So a general circuit works the same way as before. We start like this. We insert the decomposition of each of these operators, expand them. And then we can collapse this into hopping matrix, and we get to here. So we have the same structure as before. So compare that with this. The difference is just, well, you have different objects, but also the equality and the equivalence. OK, so so now we can use this to reformulate quantum theory. I'm just going to skip over this because let's just get to the key point here. So the key idea is that we want, in order to reformulate quantum theory, we want to choose a set of fiducial elements in each of these cases that correspond. We want to associate operators, fiducial operators, with fiducial operations for both the input, for both the preparation and the result case in each case, such that we get the same hopping metric. Now we know we can do that in quantum theory. You know, we know, for example, we could associate the preparation that has spin up along the z direction with this operator, and so on. So we know we can choose sets of operators that have this very basic property in quantum theory. Once we've got that, then we're basically home, because we know that in this case, the probability associated with a general circuit, is an example, is given by a diagram that looks like this. But that is also equal to an operator expansion that looks like this. Okay, since these hopping metrics are the same. Yep. Is that clear?
But eventually we want to forget about operators, right? Like, or to general properties of the A's, of the tensor tensor?
Yeah, it's a matter of taste. It's a matter of what you're trying to do. So the question you asked earlier was, how do you write down the constraints?
Yeah.
Well, you see, much easier to do that in the operator space for quantum theory, which I think is the main reason we want to use operators in quantum theory.
Yeah.
But if you're interested in general theories, maybe you want to generalize quantum theory to something beyond, then I think you'd be better off in this space.
Okay.
It depends what you're trying to do. So this is this space you're in a very general context. The only thing we've assumed is this tomographic locality principle. Whereas here, we start to be in a more specific context.
Am I correct that the basis with the white and black dots for the operators is essentially the same thing as say, for, it's essentially choosing a basis. It's like saying a linear map is equivalent to a matrix once you choose a basis in which you write that matrix. Like, you choose a basis and then you get a bunch of numbers instead of having an object, a map operating on a vector space.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, you've chosen a basis, yeah. And of course, these things will be, you can think of them as having transformation properties. Just like tensors do, these Dewar tensors will have a whole bunch of transformation properties that you may want to exploit. So just like, you know, in general relativity, you can write down a tensor with respect to some particular choice of general coordinate system. Here you can write down these Dewar tensors with respect to a particular choice of fiducial elements. But then you could also, if you want, think of them as abstract objects. You know, just like in GR, you can think of the tensors as being abstract objects that can be realized with regard to a particular coordinate system.
But wouldn't that be here, the picture with the operators, the right?
Oh, I see your point. Right. Okay, that's your question. I think even with the operators, you are, well. Yeah, this is a good question. I think you're right. I think you're right that so far as you could have chosen a different set of fiducial operators and got the same objects here.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just kind of like taking the same linear operator, writing the matrix for it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The only reason I hesitate is because I think even so, there is some, you know, if you look at these things, there is some convention as to, you know, why you choose these ones. I could have chosen, you know, I could also choose, well, no, I think you're right. I think what you said is right. Yeah. I mean, if you were going to do a calculation here, you'd want to choose a basis of your Hilbert space and expand it in terms of that basis. But that would just be another way of inserting a basis and making them into matrices. But at the general, at the abstract level, they don't have that basis. It's just abstract objects. So, yeah.
We'll see.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think the key idea is also that, so this analogy of writing your operators on the right-hand side in terms of some basis and moving from there,
mm-hmm.
I think the key idea is that that analogy holds on the right, but it's less immediately clear when you're thinking about it on the level of the circuits.
Yeah,
because you're not taking an operation and writing it as a basis. What you're doing is you're looking at the equivalence of operations, letting that be your linear decomposition.
Yeah, yeah.
That, like unifying those two.
Yeah, yeah, like right. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, yeah. I like this discussion. Yeah, I think there's still something I need to understand about this. But yeah, this is all good. Okay. So how much time do I have? Okay, this is just a slide to say. Imagine you want to work out what the operator is corresponding to some particular operation. Well, you could do that in the following way. You could do an experiment in a laboratory where you you determine these probabilities from these circuits, and then you could use the Hopping metric to make these black dots into white dots, and then you could put them in front of these operators. So that's just a way to get the get those operators experimentally. Okay. So this now is the answer to that question you asked right at the very beginning about what are the constraints. And these are the constraints. So these operators, it should say greater than zero, greater than or equal to zero. Yeah. So there's two constraints. I'll explain where they come from. Operators satisfying these two constraints I call them physical, because they correspond to things that you can actually produce in the laboratory. So one constraint is that if you take this operator, okay, you write it down in a basis, and then you perform a partial transpose over the input. So that's just a matter of flipping elements in the matrix. So in the part of the matrix associated with the input, you want to hop elements over the across the diagonal. Well, then that matrix has to be greater than or equal to zero. You can see the invisible greater than or equal to zero here. Got to put in. And this constraint, you can see if this was a matrix associated with, say, just a preparation, there'd be no subscript. So then we'd be saying that this was a positive operator. And we know that density matrices should correspond to positive operators. If it was a element corresponding just to a result, so it's an effect, well, we know that, so that says the transpose of this should be a positive operator. But now it's not a partial transpose because there's no output, which means it's just the same thing as saying that the operator is positive. The partial trans, if an operator has positive transpose, then the operator itself is positive. So we know that if we have states or effects, this is a positive operator, and that corresponds to what we know is true in quantum theory. In the general case, if you have both subscripts and superscripts, then the partial transpose matters. And this is equivalent in standard quantum theory to saying that you have a completely positive map. OK? Okay, you know, I think you learned that in Joe's course that states are super operators must be completely positive. Well, this is equivalent to that here. And then there's another requirement, and this in standard quantum theory is equivalent to the requirement that that transformations are So it, for transformations, this is equivalent to the requirement that transformations don't increase the state, the trace. If you have a density matrix and you act on it with some transformation, you want the trace of the new density matrix to be less than or equal to that of the original one, because you can't make probability one greater than probability one. And in general, here's another example. Imagine if you have a state, so there's no subscript here. This is a preparation of state. Then this is telling you that the normalization is less than or equal to one. Okay, this becomes a one because C becomes the trivial system, and so the normalization is less than or equal to one. Okay. Oh, and then if you have it's quite useful to have the angle on the end. You have just a result, then you have that so this becomes the trivial thing. So here you just have that the result is less than or equal to the identity. And that's something that we know is true in quantum theory as well. So these two conditions capture all the conditions we know we normally impose on states, transformations, and measurement outcome operators on results, but they're in a much more tidy form, written sort of how they work in general. Where do those conditions come from? Well, they come from, what you want to do is you want to consider general circuits, and you insist that for a general circuit, the probability is between 0 and 1, and you allow the following. You allow that you have all rank 1 projectors associated with preparations. All rank 1 projectors associated with results. You also allow that you have the identity effect for results. So this is the effect where you just ignore the outcome. So if you assume all these things are true, then you can prove these two conditions. Okay. It's not too difficult to show that. Okay, I think the rest of this is, since I have a few minutes or two, you can talk about a complete set of operations. That would be a set of operations associated with outcomes. So now I'm writing explicitly what the outcome is, that L equals 1 could correspond to a red light flashing. We could have a blue light flashing or so on. So you have a set of operations. Now I've got the labels of the outcomes, and it's a complete set if as you go over L, you're covering all the different possible outcomes. Okay. And a complete set of physical operators is a set of operators that satisfy these conditions. So basically, they satisfy the physicality conditions, and they sum in such a way that this equality condition is satisfied. Is that clear? I went through that very quickly. And you can see that we want to associate these things with these things. And so here are some sort of mathematical axioms for quantum theory. you say that operations correspond to operators. So for every operation, there is some operator. And furthermore, complete sets of physical operators correspond to complete sets of operation. Correspond to complete sets of operations. So for every complete set of mathematical operators you have, there exists in the laboratory some way of actually realizing that. More glib way of saying this is that complete sets of operations correspond to complete sets of operators, physical operators, and vice versa. So that gives you a way of formulating quantum theory in this more graphical language. And so the important point is that, you unify states, effects, and transformations and fragments. They're all unified into the same kind of language. You don't need to foliate when you do these calculations. There's no foliation required. You could foliate if you want, but you don't have to. There's a curious time asymmetry in the physicality condition. Let me just go back and show you that. Yeah. This condition is not time symmetric. You know, it's sort of the subscripts and superscripts are playing a different role. We expect that to be the case because in quantum theory, we know that we can have a density matrix equal to the identity over n, whereas we know we can have an effect equal to the identity. So there is an asymmetry. So that's there. But still, from a physical point of view, it's very curious. And I'll stop there. There's some other points here. I'll stop just there. Okay.